This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised.
If you're tuning in to Fruit Loops, you probably just heard our super awesome theme song. And I was twerking to our theme song earlier. I love our theme song. I'm sorry, but it just really gets your booty bouncing. So welcome. Welcome to Fruit Loops Season 2, Episode 11. Thank you so much for listening. Fruit Loops is a podcast about true crimes committed by people of color and their victims that we don't hear or know much about. Contrary to popular belief, not all serial killers are white dudes. What? Get out of here. You're lying. There are many well-documented cases of serial killers of color, and Fruit Loops is a podcast all about them. We will take deep dives into the fascinating lives and crimes of serial killers and true crimes committed by people of color and the victims that the media and entertainment commonly leave out because, well, the news is racist, allegedly.
And we are Wendy and Beth. She's Wendy. I'm Beth. We're not journalists, investigators, or psychologists. Nope. Just a couple of gals interested in true crime. Also, the opinions expressed in this podcast are just that, our opinions. Please send any questions or comments to fruitloopspod@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 602-935-6294, and we may feature it in a future episode. Also, our website is fruitloopspod.com, our Facebook page is Fruit Loops Pod, and our discussion group is Fruit Loops Pod Discussion on Facebook. We are also on Twitter and Instagram at Fruit Loops Pod. Everything is Fruit Loops Pod, so just search for that.
Get at us. Now, if you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash App, which you can download to your phone, or you can find online at cash.me/$FruitLoopsPod, or you can become a monthly patron through our patron page on Podbean. Or if you can't help monetarily, no problem. You can always give us a 5-star review on iTunes or anywhere else you get your podcast from. And be sure to share our podcast with your friends and family.
Amen.
So, Beth, who are we talking about today?
Today we are talking about Harrison Graham, also known as the Corpse Collector, a Black American serial killer from Philadelphia who raped and murdered 7 women in the 1980s.
Oh, me, oh, my. I can't wait to get into it. So, before we do that, how you doing?
I'm still sick.
Oh, great.
Working on week 3, but it's nothing serious. Just annoying, yeah. I think as I was getting over the last bug, I caught something else. And so, like, last Thursday, I was so tired. I actually took a nap at work.
Oh, poor baby. You know what? I did the same thing, actually. I took a note from you and slept in that little room.
Yeah, the indisposed room.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had to be at work because one of my coworkers was not in that day. And so we had to cover for her. And so I kind of had to be there. So I figured it was better to go take a nap in the indisposed room than to go home. Well, I would have preferred to go home, but, you know.
Well, thank God for you. think of. Yeah.
So I think the stress of Christmas lowers my immune system. I always get sick after Christmas.
Really? Every year?
Yeah, pretty much every year. Yeah, right after Christmas.
Oh, man.
And I was listening to a podcast where it was a couple of white dudes, and they were talking about how they were relaxing over the holidays and now they had to get back to work. I'm like, are you serious?
You sons of bitches.
Because as a female with a family, if you have kids, you know you're working over the holidays. You know you're making food, you're entertaining, you're making sure everybody's happy. And I don't know. I guess there's the rare male who is helping out, but I think a lot of them get to relax.
Most oh my gosh, I don't know if I'm not here to bash any dudes. My husband, old Whitey, aka get off my lawn, aka can I speak to a manager, he is always chilling. I have not sat on my couch for the past maybe 10 years. I haven't sat on my couch in 10 years. And he's over here just chilling.
Chilling on the couch, yeah.
Just chilling.
Yeah, I think that's pretty common.
Dudes do. They're so good at it.
Yeah, I'm not here to bash men, but I think it is pretty common that, like, the holidays, we're all working our asses off and it's very stressful, and they're over there like, oh, this is so relaxing. There's all this nice stuff happening falling right into my lap. It's great.
Oh my gosh. Well, same girl, same. And I'm so sorry you're so sick still. Golly, that is a long time to be dealing with illness. Ooh.
Fucking annoying. Tell you what.
Well, I rebuke you, illness. I'm so sorry. That's awful. That's the worst. That being sick is no fun. So I just am praying for wellness for you. You're on my prayer list, okay, Bev?
Well, thank you.
You're so welcome. So let's get into some listener letters.
The angels, they're here.
Here they are. So we've been away because it was the holidays and everything. When we announced our return, we got some really, really sweet messages from listeners who had missed us. So thank you all for rocking with us, for fucking with us, and for sticking with us. These two messages came from Instagram. And again, we announced that we're back. And this first message is from RL Cox on Instagram. She said, I can't wait. I spent the last 2 weeks catching up from episode 1. And so to you, my RL Cox listener, we love you so much. And thank you, all the hip hop air horns.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yes. And the next message we got was from at the Purple Lurple. Hello. I like that name too. That's a good one. I've just started listening and I love your podcasts. Purple Lurple said on episode 3, and I'm already hooked. It's made me wonder if any POC are serial killers in the UK.
Oh, we got one for you, girl.
Hey. Yeah, we do. And we just have the same issue with racist reporting here. There are only ever white blokes. Oh, I love that she said blokes. Reported as being multi-murderers over here. Thank you so much, RL Cox and the Purple Lurple, for fucking with us. Love you both. And be prepared to receive blessings via hip hop air horn. Fruit Loops loves you.
Yes, yes. And yes. Also, hip hop air horn, big hip hop air horn for our new patron, Helen, in the UK.
Hey, Helen! Helen, thank you. Thank you so, so much. You really, really are helping us out. We appreciate it. So let's take a quick break and get into the story when we come back.
We would like to invite any listeners who have a business to advertise to do it with us. For more information, please email us at fruitloopspod@gmail.com or check out our website at fruitloopspod.com.
So, who are we talking about again today, Bev?
Today we're talking about Harrison Graham, also known as the Corpse Collector, a Black American serial killer from Philadelphia who raped and murdered 7 women in the 1980s, and he was apprehended in 1987.
Ooh, all right. So let's get into some stats. So, let's see, Harrison Graham, a.k.a. Marty. And by the way, Beth, I didn't realize that he had a cool nickname, the Corpse Collector.
Yeah, I only saw it in a few places, but I liked it.
Okay, then I'll take it.
It's sick as fuck, but I like it.
It is. It's a good one. So that's the dude we are talking about. Couple of sources referred to him as mentally retarded. We don't use that R word anymore, but that's what the sources said. He was a drug abuser and necrophiliac. Again, I do not appreciate the R word, and I don't know if I believe that he was actually mentally handicapped. We'll get into that more later. He was arrested on August 17th, 1987. His victims were mostly female addicts of color. His method of murder was strangulation. The location of the crimes occurred in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And currently he is serving a life sentence in prison. Let's see. I think he was also sentenced to 6 electrocutions. that's
6 electrocutions.
That's a lot of electrocutions. Something happened with the laws, and he was deemed incompetent to be executed in December of 2003 because of his mental status. But we'll get into that later. So
right.
Now we're going to talk about where this took place. The setting, Philly Penn, is rich with racist history. So let's get into it.
Yeah. So Philadelphia, also known as the City of Brotherly Love, in the mid-1980s, that's when this took place. Let's talk a little bit about the history of the setting, because circumstances create context and it matters.
It show as shit does. Philadelphia is known as the birthplace of the United States and is notable for its rich history. Oh, yes, indeed. If you visit Philadelphia today, you can see the Liberty Bell. Oh, great. Independence Hall, where the Declaration of Independence and Constitution were signed. Carpenter's Hall, where the First Continental Congress met, and other American Revolutionary sites.
And I don't know about you, Wendy, but as I was researching this, I had to turn on Hamilton.
Hey, Alexander Hamilton.
Yep. So I was listening to that soundtrack while I was writing this.
Yes.
So the National Park Service started doing more consultation with the African-American community around 2003, which surprised me because it seems so late in the game. Like, kinda. 2003, you're finally consulting with the African-American community?
By the way, so 16, I think 1619 is when the first Black slave was, or the first Black person was brought to the American continent, brought to the United States. And
so 400 years later.
This year is the anniversary. Hooray!
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the National Park Service incorporated exhibits at the Liberty Bell Center that told about slavery and provided ways for the African American community to participate in decisions about a memorial. In 2007, the National Park Service undertook a public archaeology project to excavate artifacts and assess the findings at the site of the President's House.
Okay, that sounds nice. Completed in 2010, the memorial President's House, Freedom and Slavery in the Making of a New Nation, shows the outline of the original buildings and allows visitors to view the remaining foundations. The commemorative open-air installation marks the site where the nation's first two presidents, George Washington, not a fan, and John Adams, also not a fan, served their terms in office.
It also pays tribute to the 9 documented enslaved persons of African descent who were part of the Washington household. And I actually did not know that Washington had slaves.
No.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
He was actually his reputation as a slave owner was not good. He was actually pretty violent. Yeah, he was not a good slave owner. So
I didn't know.
Yeah. Yeah, they don't tell us in the history books.
No, they don't. And hopefully they're doing better now, but they sure didn't when I was a kid. So
same with me. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The inclusion of the topic of enslavement was an addition to the historic district of Philadelphia that has in the past been absent or minimized. In attempts to recognize the broader picture of the people who participated in the nation's early history, including enslaved and free people of African descent, the President's House calls attention to the complex juxtaposition of slavery and freedom.
The first abolition society was founded in Philadelphia in 1775. 17 of the 24 men who attended initial meetings of the society were Quakers. Benjamin Franklin was elected as the organization's president sometime after 1785. The society asked him to bring the matter of slavery to the Constitutional Convention of 1787. Hey, that's where our boy Alexander Hamilton was. He was asked to join the Constitutional Convention. And he petitioned the U.S. Congress in 1790 to ban slavery.
The Pennsylvania Abolition Society, which had members and leaders of both races, became a model for anti-slavery organizations in other states during the antebellum years. And the Pennsylvania Abolition Society still exists today.
Does it now? Wow.
Yeah, dedicated to the cause of combating racism. It's the oldest abolitionist organization in the United States. And since the late 20th century, it has worked to improve issues of criminal justice and the overrepresentation of African Americans in prison, reduction in harsh sentencing laws, and improving economic and environmental justice.
In March 1780, an act for the gradual abolition of slavery was passed by the Pennsylvania legislature, which prescribed an end for slavery in Pennsylvania. It was the first act abolishing slavery in the course of human history to be adopted by democracy way before the Emancipation Proclamation. So shout out to Philly Penn for being like super progressive for its time. It didn't end slavery in Pennsylvania since the existing enslaved people were not freed, but children born to enslaved people were free, and that's cool. And it was the beginning of the end.
The city's large free Black community aided fugitive enslaved people and founded the first independent Black denomination in the nation, the African Methodist Episcopal Church. Philadelphia became one of the first U.S. industrial centers, with a variety of industries, the largest being textiles. In the years following the Civil War, Philadelphia's population continued to grow. A large portion of the growth came from immigrants, still mostly Irish and German. In 1870, 27% of Philadelphia's population was born outside of the United States.
Whoa. By the way, I am an AME, African Methodist Episcopalian. My dad was a AME preacher. And me and my husband, old Whitey, get off my lawn. Can I speak to a manager? We got married in an AME church. So, oh, wow. That's cool. Yeah. So, anyway, tangent. The population declined in the 1950s. Most of that is likely due to white flight. Black people were fleeing racial violence, and Philadelphia was one of the stops on the Great Migration Tour. We've talked about this before in past episodes. Black people moved into the cities where the jobs were and where the red lines allowed them to live. Hashtag redlining. Look it up. And it was too close for comfort for white people. So white people left the neighborhoods where all these black people were migrating to.
And many of Philadelphia's houses were in poor condition and lacked proper facilities. Gang and mafia warfare plagued the city. Revitalization and gentrification of certain neighborhoods started bringing people back to the city. Promotions and incentives in the 1990s led to improving the city's image and slowed the population decline.
Normally, poor, browner people settle in the south of cities, but in Philadelphia, different. The immigrants from Asia, Central, and South America settled there in the 80s and the 90s, and the poorer black or browner people actually live in North Philly. And in 1987, the Philadelphia Flyers went toe-to-toe with the Edmonton Oilers in the seven-game Stanley Cup series. I don't know anything about hockey. Black people don't care about hockey. But we just wanted to paint the picture of what was going on at this time. Unfortunately for Philadelphia, they did not win that year.
And during the 1980s, the city of Pennsylvania was home to three notorious serial killers.
Three? Oh, my.
Gary Heidnik, who kidnapped, tortured, and raped six African-American women and held them in a pit in his basement. Two of them were murdered. Yeah. The Frankfurt Slasher was a serial killer who operated in and around the neighborhood of Frankfurt in Philadelphia in 1985 to 1990. And he sexually assaulted and stabbed to death nine women. Yeah. A man named Leonard Christopher was convicted in the murder of one of the nine supposedly linked victims. But the others actually remain unsolved, and some people don't believe that Leonard Christopher is guilty. And then lastly, Harrison Graham, the guy we're talking about today.
That's right. So, Beth, have you heard of any of these other serial killers before?
Heidnik I had heard of, but not...
I did not mean to push that button. I'm sorry.
Listen to letters, everybody. Angels are here.
I am very sorry for being so unprofessional.
I had not heard of the Frankfurt Slasher and Christopher Leonard or Harrison Graham. I hadn't heard of him either. Yeah.
Hey, me either. That was a lot for one city. Three serial killers is a lot. But by the 1980s, there was an increase in serial murders across the country, especially those that involved uniquely gruesome details. Graham was active at the same time as Heidnik, but Heidnik's crimes and victims consumed most of the media attention. I wonder why. It starts with an R and ends with acism. So now we're going to get into the killer's early life. So let's talk about Graham when he was a little boy.
Okay, so Harrison, who also went as Marty Graham, was born September 9th, 1959 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He was the oldest of five children. His mother was Lillian Graham Jeter. According to Lillian, Marty was diagnosed with a mental disorder when he was 12 and was hospitalized for 2 years. He was also classified as learning disabled, and he lived in a foster home from age 2 to 7. His foster mom said she never saw him learn to read or write.
Fun fact, he liked to talk like the Cookie Monster from Sesame Street, and he had a Cookie Monster doll or puppet that he kept even as an adult. He liked to play basketball with the local kids and do his Cookie Monster impression. He also allegedly liked digging graves for dogs. Oh, which is weird. And he did it in nearby vacant lots. And Graham was a high school dropout who read at a third grade reading level. And he also couldn't tell time. So
yeah, and the thing about the digging graves for dogs was only in one article. Not sure if it's true or not. It was only cited in the one article. And there's some other things that were in that article that I'm not sure about either. So we'll go over those.
Yeah.
And we didn't come across any actual records of abuse, but if he was in foster care, it's not inconceivable that abuse was present in his life, prompting the state to take him from his mom's house at age 2 and not returning him until age 7. And who knows what happened to him when he was hospitalized for a mental disorder at age 12 for 2 years.
Yeah. So since, you know, we're doing this show and the recent R. Kelly docuseries has come out, and one point I've heard discussed on the hip hop and black ass podcast that I listen to in my feed, you know, are they're going back to the beginning. Slavery. During slavery, slaves were forced to have intercourse with each other to create more slaves for the master. And if they couldn't procreate by a certain age, they would castrate the males and then sell them. Slaves did not have agency, nor could they give consent to engage in sexual acts. Many slave masters abused their female and young male slaves sexually and physically. Those abuses have been to the detriment of the Black community and have continued through generations. It's a dark point, but I don't know if we've discussed this before in past podcasts. And if we're going to discuss perps of color, I kind of think that it's important to bring up, because I think that with these killers and their crimes, abuse is often what leads to these people becoming the sick fucks that they end up being.
Yeah.
And I just think that we should go back to the beginning, and I don't discount the horrors of slavery and how those abuses have may have contributed to this. So
yeah, and I've always thought, you know, when you destroy somebody's whole community, like you take these people from Africa, or in the case of Native Americans, you just destroy their entire culture, you know, and then replace it with some fucked up shit, then there's going to be some problems. Hello?
Yeah, there's going to be some problems. Anyway, let's get into the timeline.
So let's get into some more fucked up shit. Here we go.
Yeah, here we go. Let's do it. All right.
This timeline's going to be pretty short, because we don't have a lot of dates, unfortunately. But we do know that the house that Graham lived in, and for which he paid $90 a month for his apartment, was pretty run down.
Wow.
And by some accounts, looked abandoned. According to one article, and this is the article I mentioned earlier, the front entrance to the building had a broken down door with rubble in front of it, and the front windows had been shattered. Drugs ran rampant, this we know, and the house stood 3 miles from Gary Heidnik's House of Horrors.
Shut the fuck up.
Yep, it's all in the same area. And as an aside, I Googled how far the house was from Temple University, and it's less than a mile. In 82 or 83, I visited the campus with my parents.
Okay.
To decide whether or not I wanted to go there. We drove around the area, and I pretty much decided right then and there that I was not going to that school.
How come?
Because the neighborhood scared the crap out of me. It was like a lot of abandoned looking buildings, like nailed up windows, and it was really run down. Yeah, it was really run down. And I was coming from a small town in Connecticut that was, you know, cute and
enough said.
Yeah,
enough said. Connecticut to Philly Pen. I already understand that might have been much.
I was coming from a town like the Gilmore Girls lived in, you know?
Oh, Jesus Christ. Help us, Lord.
I was like, oh my God, can we go home now?
This is too much.
And I'm actually glad that I didn't go because I was kind of wild when I was young. And I
I don't believe it for a second.
I did.
You were wild. You
was a little wild. Yeah.
Oh,
I like to drink, and I didn't know. You know what? You're young, 18, 19 years old. You don't know your limits yet. And
right.
Sometimes I would drink a little too much, and who knows? Who knows what would happen? You know, find myself in an abandoned building doing heroin. Who knows?
So if you had gone to that school in Philly, Penn, you might not have made it. You might not have made it.
I might have died right there.
Oh, no. Oh, that reminds me of all the times I was so stupid in college.
We were all stupid.
Oh my God. I went to college in LA. So we would go to these clubs, and the rule was if we came together, we leave together. But I'd be right. I just met this nice 50-year-old man. He said he's going to take me home and take care of me. Oh, so I'll see
like
you guys
a good
later.
Idea to me.
good night, guys. And my friends would be like, are you fucking crazy? Yes, I was.
Yes, so, I am. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah, I did
am.
Some stupid ass shit. So, yeah, I'm lucky I didn't die. That's why I'm like, when we do the tips for how not to get murdered, no judgment, girls, because I have been there. I'm just lucky.
No, girl. Yes, absolutely. I'm giving you an internet high five right now because we made it. So, Beth, you really never cease to amaze me. The East Coast, man, I can only imagine how crazy things got over there. So, Harrison, the guy we're talking about, was known as Marty by his neighbors. He was described as quiet, easygoing. Women tenants were not in fear of him. In fact, he had done handiwork for some of them, and he had no history of posing any sort of threat. Harrison Graham, later told police he began killing in January of 1986. His known victims were killed in that same year. Unfortunately, we don't know the exact dates of the women's deaths, but we do have their names. And here they go, because they matter. Cynthia Brooks, she was 27. Valerie Jameson was 26. Mary Jeter Mathis was 36. Barbara Mahoney was 22. Robin DeShazor was 29. Sandra Garvin was 33. And Patricia Franklin was 24. So now we are going to get into the investigation and arrest. Take it away, Beth.
All right. On Sunday, August 9th, 1987, Graham was evicted from his home due to a terrible odor coming from his apartment, which tenants had been complaining about. Before he left, he nailed the door to one of the rooms shut and said that he would be back for the rest of his stuff later. His landlord, Nathaniel Choice, had sent his son and nephew over to the apartment to take care of business. And I have to say, this guy is a slumlord for sure.
Yeah. I was going to say, it sounds Trumpy-ish.
Yeah, it does. It does sound Trumpy-ish. Mm-hmm. So he sent over his son and his nephew. And when they could not open the door to the room that had been nailed shut and had no doorknob, they decided to peek through the keyhole. And that's when they called the police.
All right. Officer Pete Scalantino walked up to the door of the third floor and into the first room of the apartment. There he saw knee-high piles of trash everywhere, gross, including food containers, discarded syringes, Jesus Christ, molded newspapers and magazines, dried feces and filthy clothes, sheets, boards, and boxes. On a kitchen wall, there were some rough sketches. One was the drawing of a naked woman with aggressive expletives scrawled next to it, and a smear that looked like dried blood left by the dragging of two fingers in parallel.
The man who'd called him told him to look through the keyhole, so he bent down near a door that had Marty scrawled across it to have a look. The officer looked into the keyhole and saw a woman's exposed legs. He knocked and announced himself, and when there was no answer or movement within, he forced the door and entered the room. There he discovered that the woman on a mattress was deceased. She'd been dead for some time, and next to the mattress on a pile of trash was another female corpse.
Holy fucking shit! That's too many dead bodies for one place.
I think one is too many.
Right there. A homicide detective joined the search team around 3:45 p.m. They turned up a third set of remains. Jesus fucking Christ, wrapped in two sheets and buried under the debris beneath the second body. These were nearly skeletal, so they probably were there for a while, but had shreds of clothing. Less than 2 hours later, the searchers turned up a fourth set of mummified remains inside some sheets. Jesus Christ.
And a fifth body was found around 5:30 p.m., pulled out of another area of debris. But the peculiar detail about this one was that he or she, they couldn't tell, had been sandwiched between two mattresses. The searchers wondered if the evicted tenant had actually slept on the top mattress with the victim underneath, like a dried flower smashed between pages of a book.
Stop it.
I just stopped.
Get out of here. Get the fuck out of here. That's
disgusting.
I'm thinking Princess and the Pea.
Oh, yeah, except for a dead body instead of a pea. I don't feel anything. No. You're not a princess.
You are not a princess. Oh, no. Oh, Lord. Help us. All right. It appeared as though the tenant had resided in one room and had kept the adjoining room as his own private mausoleum. Another 2 hours went by before a sixth body was located, crammed inside a tiny 6-inch deep closet, sitting up, wrapped in a sheet and tied with white electrical cord. Another decomposed body, another one, was found. Oh, Jesus. Outside the window, on the roof.
On the roof.
Up on the roof. Detectives also found notebooks in Marty's home that allegedly featured crude sketches of naked women and dismembered body parts. Oh, boy.
Woo. So the search for Marty Graham was on. When he left, Graham had taken a water bottle, some items of clothing, and his raggedy blue Cookie Monster puppet. Investigators learned that Graham was known to take long walks. Sorry, okay. I was just thinking of like a dating website. I like taking long walks with my Cookie Monster puppet.
On the beach, yes, with my Cookie Monster puppet.
Yeah. He was known to take long walks and play basketball with local kids. He liked to entertain them with his Cookie Monster puppet. Other neighbors said he was a loner, but when he got drunk, he'd act a little crazy.
Just a little.
Just a little. And he talked to his puppet all the time. That's not crazy.
No big deal. Do you guys want to see my Cookie Monster puppet? No.
Is that a
that's
euphemism?
Okay. My mom says I shouldn't talk to you. Police released a fuzzy photo of Graham across the city. People who knew him offered police tips on where he'd been since his eviction, but the leads didn't go anywhere. several women came forward and said Graham tried to rape them or hit them on the head.
One of the bodies was able to be identified, but the remainder of the bodies required an anthropologist to assist in identification via bone structure. Holy shit. They couldn't even tell the race or sex of the bodies.
Jesus fucking Christ. The ME's office stated that the six of the victims had been black females and one had been identified. Mary Jeter Mathis. She was 36. She was the mother of five children. Five children left without their mama. While DNA analysis had been used in several forensic contexts that same year, it was not yet a common method for victim identification.
The area was no stranger to drug overdoses in abandoned buildings, but at the same time, families lived there too. Graham's involvement in the crime was shocking to his neighbors, even to some of his less than upstanding cohabitants. He was known as a handyman around the neighborhood and was considered quiet and friendly.
Word on the street, specifically from drug users, provided a different slant on the story. While Harrison Graham appeared to be mild-mannered, he was also dealing some of the more popular drugs, as well as participating in the lifestyle. The drug lifestyle. He would allow people to use his apartment to inject drugs. He received $300 each month in Social Security, but appeared to be supplementing with the drug money that he was earning.
Graham was still nowhere to be found. The sought-after suspect had four younger siblings and his mother, Lily, all living in the Philadelphia area. Graham's family did not believe that he was guilty, and the family put out a public plea for Harrison to come home. He'd been seen at local shelters, even on a city bus, but he'd somehow continued to elude investigators. His mother urged him to turn himself in, and he finally did on August 17th.
Graham was arrested only months after fellow Philadelphian Gary Heidnick was arrested for similar crimes. Though Heidnick earned more publicity, guess why? Just kidding. We know. It's racism. news coverage of Graham's crimes was limited mainly to the Philadelphia area. Criminal justice professor Anthony Walsh suggests that the lack of media attention to Graham's crimes is symptomatic of a broader unawareness or neglect of black serial killers in America. Though African-American, Graham killed more people than white Heidnick. The media all but ignored Graham's crimes. And I wanted to interject here because welcome to Culture Corner with Wendy and Beth. Personally, I just got to say, I think it's more appropriate, more respectful to say black as opposed to African-American. I've discussed this with a white dude a couple months ago, and he was like, should I say black or should I say African-American when I'm talking about somebody who's highly melanated? And I told him I thought African-American was fair, but it is in my opinion an antiquated term. For me, black people are not a monolith, so other black people might feel differently. So a highly melanated person from a different time and place than me might feel differently about this using this term. If you call me African-American, I get offended because you're denying my mother's side of me. And not all black people are African-American. People of African descent, due to the slave trade and migration, the diaspora is very vast. African-American is only a fraction of it. So now we're back to the story. Gary Heidnick.
So anyway, Gary Heidnick.
That is the most vanilla name I ever.
Such a white name. Yeah, Gary.
So Gary Heidnick was still awaiting trial on murder, kidnapping, and torture charges when the city police officers made the grisly discovery at Graham's apartment in the summer of 1987.
The police interrogated Graham. At first, he said he didn't kill anyone, that the bodies were there when he moved in. And he was like, hey, there's some bodies. Oh, whatever.
We're friends. I know. I shouldn't laugh. Okay.
Then he said that he only killed two of them, you know, and the other ones, I don't know.
Okay.
They just like appeared. I don't know.
They just showed up there. Yeah.
They're like magnets, you know, you kill two, next thing you know, there's four.
What is all this doing here?
Finally, he admitted to killing all of them. He said that he meant to get them drunk and high and then strangle them during sex. Then he'd pass out and wake up with the body next to him, and he was surprised every time.
Oh, my God. Wow. How fucked up do you have to be like, more than once to be like, yeah, there's a dead body next to me. Yeah, oh,
who
no.
knew that strangling somebody would kill them? Who knew?
Holy shit. I was into some kinky shit. She was into some kinky shit, too. And next thing you know, she's dead. And I'm here. Okay.
What are you going to do? You just stuff them in a closet underneath a mattress, on the roof, whatever. Yeah.
I don't know. No big deal. he said... He didn't mean to kill anyone, but through perhaps his sexual technique. Okay, his sexual technique. He held the women around the neck and probably pressed too hard. Now, I don't know if you've ever been choked during sex, Beth, but it does feel really good. But if you're going to die, that's not good. Investigators assumed he was illiterate. But Graham actually read his Bible regularly, and a racist source, I'm calling it a racist source, that we found said that he was surprisingly articulate and talented as an artist. And I say racist because I think it's racist for white people to call people of color articulate.
Yeah, or anyway. Surprisingly articulate.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That's this black worse. Person knows yeah. English?
Yeah. Okay, wow. Graham said he killed his first victim, and then he didn't know what to do with the body, so he put it on the roof, accessible by a window. He didn't mind the maggots, but the birds did bother him.
All right, that's creepy. Graham's competency to stand trial was in question. Dr. Robert Stanton indicated that Graham had an IQ of 63, below the level considered mentally competent, and that Graham was a serious substance abuser of alcohol and drugs and was thus unable to cooperate in his own defense. He suffered from auditory hallucinations, blackouts. He was psychotic with chronic paranoid features.
Psychologist Albert Levitt said that Graham was unable to read, write, or even tell time. He was highly distractible. But Dr. Robert Sardoff, hired by the DA's office, declared that Graham had no significant mental impediment to assisting his attorney. He was able to respond to my questions, Sardoff told a reporter. He was able to give police a statement. It was coherent. It was logical. Judge Edward Meckel declared Graham competent to be prosecuted.
All right. Well, according to a Psychology Today article, defense attorney Joel Moldovsky had prepared well for his client. It wasn't just insanity, he said. These acts had been due to Graham's multiple personality disorder. Graham was presented as having three distinct personalities. Frank was a foul-mouthed, drug-addicted murderer. Junior was an unmanageable two-year-old who adored the Cookie Monster, and Marty was the likable handyman who complied with the police. Interesting take.
Multiple personality disorder is now referred to as dissociative identity disorder, or DID. Mm-hmm. It's a condition in which a person's identity is fragmented into two or more distinct personality states. People with this very rare condition are usually victims of severe physical and sexual abuse. It's a controversial diagnosis, and some people believe that because DID patients are easily hypnotized, their symptoms are actually caused by treatment, meaning that they arise in response to therapist suggestions, kind of like false recovered memories. Brain imaging studies, however, have corroborated identity transitions in some patients.
Some people think DID is complete and utter bullshit. but I am not one of those people. DID reflects a failure to integrate various aspects of identity, memory, and consciousness into a single multidimensional self. Usually, a primary identity carries the individual's given name and is passive, dependent, guilty, and depressed. When in control, each personality state or alter may be experienced as if it has a distinct history, self-image, and identity. The alter's characteristics, including name, reported age and gender, vocabulary, general knowledge, and predominant mood, contrast with those of the primary identity. Certain circumstances or stressors can cause a particular alter to emerge. The various identities may deny knowledge of one another, be critical of one another, or appear to be in open conflict.
And we can't verify this account, but according to one article, the one fishy article,
yes,
at an early age, Harrison was both a lover to and employee of a male pimp. Troubles at home led him to the streets, where for the first time, Harrison claims to have felt deeply loved. But in his early teens, his mother had a spiritual revelation and turned to Christianity. She began to preach the immoralities of his lifestyle, one that she'd been uninvolved in for a very long time. This led to one of his splits between Frank and Marty. Again, we only read this in one place, and it's not corroborated, but that's what somebody said.
Yeah, there you go. Fruit Loops is giving you the scoop. You decide, okay?
You decide.
Yeah. Jesus. Graham's case was not decided by a jury. Instead, it was a bench trial decided upon by a judge. The defense was afraid that the gruesome evidence would sway jurors. The prosecutor offered some powerful witnesses. Two women said they'd lived with Graham and survived, but just barely. One testified that during sex, he would place his hand around her throat and squeeze again. It is super kinky and fun. I'm just saying. several times she thought he was killing her. He told her, she said that she'd killed one of his former girlfriends in anger. The second witness confirmed that Graham had confessed to this killing. He'd also threatened her with a machete. I saw this in our doc. Uh-huh. So I am half immigrant. I'm an anchor baby, essentially.
Okay.
And my grandpa used to have just machetes just lying around the backyard. Me and my cousins used to play with machetes all the time. God. I know. How are we still alive? Anyway, on with the story. Sorry.
A psychiatrist for the defense said that since Graham had said he could not recall the first five murders, it was not possible to judge his mental state at the time of those crimes. However, during the last two incidents, he'd hallucinated the voices of both God and the devil. Therefore, he'd been psychotic.
Okay.
Graham.
Graham, at 28 years old, was found guilty of 7 counts of first-degree murder at the end of a 7-week non-jury trial. Common Pleas Judge Robert A. Latrone. The judge sentenced Graham to life in prison for death of one victim whose near-skeletal remains were found scattered around the apartment. Fuck you! Latrone said there were no proven aggravating circumstances warranting the death penalty for that murder.
Latrone then sentenced Graham to death for the 6 other killings, citing the life sentence he received for the first murder as an aggravating circumstance, warranting capital punishment for successive murders under Pennsylvania law. In addition, Graham received 7 1-to-2-year sentences for the abuse of a corpse. Latrone ordered all the sentences to be served consecutively.
According to his attorneys, Graham, who sat passively through most of his trial and the sentencing, just blinked and shook his head. Moldovsky later told reporters, "I assume he knows he was found guilty, but I'm not sure."
At the end of his sentencing, Graham stretched and snapped his fingers and, before being led away by sheriff's deputies, asked the attorney if he could have his Cookie Monster puppet back. The judge denied him the hand puppet since it was evidence, but said he could keep his glove and finger puppets that sat on the defense table during his trial.
Wow. Cookie Monster does it again. The sentences were a mix of both life without parole and death. And in an unusual move, the judge decided that Graham should not be executed until after he'd served the life sentence. It meant that Graham had, in effect, received a life sentence without the possibility of parole. So that's it for the timeline and the investigation. So where are they now?
Graham's death sentences were vacated in 2003 due to his low IQ and indicators of early onset mental illness. He was considered not competent to be executed.
Huh. Well, he is being housed at the State Correctional Institution at Cole Township, commonly referred to as SCI Cole Township, a Pennsylvania Department of Corrections prison. SCI Cole Township houses about 2,300 inmates. And so now we are going to get into what we think made him snap. Hit it, Beth.
It sounds like this guy had a pretty rough childhood. They talk about his parents, but that he also spent time in foster care from the age of 2 to 7. So there's a huge gap of information in there that we know nothing about. There was probably some abuse and neglect, but we don't know the details on that. Just that one fishy story. Not sure how true it is. But it's not out of the realm of possibility that that happened or that other abuse happened. And I have read that although he has been described in many places as mentally handicapped, there are other people who don't think his IQ was as low as they thought. And drug usage probably had a lot to do with his mental status. And of course, his attorney alleged that he had dissociative identity disorder. And it may well be that the first murder was an accident, but that he was also always high as fuck on drugs. So it didn't really bother him that much. And maybe he even enjoyed it. So he just kept doing it. I do suspect that whatever abuse that may have happened in his childhood probably had a lot to do with it. I mean, as we have all heard in these types of stories before, it's kind of a blueprint for creating a serial killer. I'd also like to know why he was hospitalized at the age of 12, what mental disorder he allegedly had. I have actually known people who are put in mental institutions simply because their parents couldn't handle them. And in there, they're drugged up and actually traumatized by the experience rather than helped. And really, there's nothing wrong with them. They're just, you know, teenagers. And I wonder
like
if this
Angelina
is what
Jolie
happened.
And Girl Interrupted?
Yeah, just like that. And I wonder if this is what happened to Graham.
Ooh. You know what? You might be onto something there, Beth. Man.
Could be.
Count. We always can count on the OG of true crime to set us straight. So I have no fucking clue how this individual snapped. We can only speculate. I wanted to point out that growing up Black in America is traumatic in itself. That's evident even today. Suicide rates among children are on the rise, and the number of suicides that are occurring, more Black kids are killing themselves more than non-Black kids. So that's troubling. Also, having a learning disability, being poor, I think all of those things led to his drug abuse as a way to cope with his circumstances. I'm probably, I could be wrong, but that's just my inference.
Oh, I'm sure that drug abuse was a way to cope. I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah. He was trying to cope with his circumstances. Like Beth always says, though, not an excuse, only an explanation. Yeah. And I was under the impression that he committed these crimes while he was fucked up. And then he coped with the filth and the terrible things that he did by being even more fucked up. And yeah, he just continued being fucked up until the smell was too much for his neighbors and the jig was up. So bye.
Yeah.
So they kicked him out. So
yeah, I'm pretty sure he was pretty much high as fuck all the time. Yeah.
I think so too. Yeah. So now we are going to get into our takeaways. Well, this story is gross. This dude is nasty as fuck. But what's even more nasty is what little coverage this received. What the hell?
Yeah, yeah.
He killed more people than that white dude. What the hell? No other contrast of white and Black serial killers is more evident than a comparison of the 1987 arrest of these two multiple murders in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Gary Heidnik, a white male accused of double murder, was arrested on March 24th, 1987. And coincidentally, Black serial killer Harrison Graham was arrested less than 5 months later on August 16th, 1987, for the murder of seven women. Heidnik received far more publicity, both at the time and later. During the trial, Harrison Graham, the Philadelphia Daily News, reported that the prosecutor suggested that Graham's ability to commit multiple crimes and then conceal them suggests he was more mentally functional than his lawyers have maintained. That same fucking newspaper years earlier described Harrison Graham as having the mind of a child. Fuck you guys. While the Philadelphia Inquirer suggested that he was mentally retarded. Fuck you guys for using that word. In contrast, even though Gary Heidnik failed to meet the FBI standard for a serial murderer, he was nonetheless elevated to the status within pop culture through film and books. For instance, Heidnik became the archetype for Buffalo Bill. Ever heard of him? In the Thomas Harris novel, as well as the subject of England's nonfictional Cellar of Horrors, which is a book. Have you read it, Beth?
I have not read that Cellar one.
Cellar of Horrors. Okay. Harrison Graham has not, to date, been the sole subject. Are you listening to this? He has not been the sole subject of any books or movies, despite his numerous victims. All right. I need to do a gunshot or a hip hop air horn or some sort of sound effect to mark the bullshit.
Were you able to find any like YouTube videos or anything?
No.
Yeah.
No.
I couldn't either.
You know, here a little behind the scenes. So Beth reads and I don't like to read. I don't like to read. I read really slow and it's just really frustrating to me. So I like listening to books. I like watching things. And so that's how I get my information that I contribute to the documents and the information that we provide to you guys. And I couldn't find anything.
You must have had to read because you did contribute.
I had to read. It was awful. It was awful.
Terrible. See how much Wendy loves you guys. She read for you.
I read for you guys. Okay. I hate it. Oh my lordy. Oh
so,
my
yeah, lanta. I couldn't find any YouTube videos either. Not even like some crappy one, you know, with a bunch of racist people.
I know, because when you do find YouTube videos, they're always by these white people who have no idea what they're talking about. Okay.
So my takeaways, I started out hating this guy and then ended up feeling kind of sorry for him. I know. He's a murderer.
Okay. Understood.
I know. I feel both disgusted by him, and I have sympathy for him as a child, I guess. My daughter works with a lot of foster kids, and they have it pretty rough. A lot of them, they're with the foster families, but their parents are still in the picture, and they come for visitation, and sometimes they don't show up, and that upsets the kids, and then they act out in class, and it's just horrible. It's heartbreaking. Whether or not this guy was as mentally challenged as they thought, or if he was just slightly mentally challenged, I do think he was at least slightly mentally challenged. And then all the time high as fuck. And or he had a mental disorder, because he could also have had a mental disorder on top of all that. He probably wasn't the brightest bulb. And he probably did not get the help that he needed as a child. So, I mean, even people who are not that bright, they can still contribute to society. We still, need people to work jobs that, you know, have to be the brightest bulb to do. You know, we still need
just look at Nine.
Yeah, exactly.
Perfect example.
These are still, you know, they're people, they're human beings, you know. Just because he's not, super smart doesn't mean that he should be treated like shit. I mean, I'm just talking about him as a child, you know.
As a child, right. Absolutely. Yeah.
And again, that's another story that's sad all the way around, from the child who was neglected and abused to the women who were murdered. Just super sad.
Yeah, it is sad. That's on all these true crime cases, we always come back to where these people started out, and the beginnings are always really sad. And they start out sad, and then they end up sad.
Yeah.
So yeah. So it's just kind of sad. Now we are going to get into the part of our show where we talk about how not to get murdered. So let me do the jingle. If you love true crime and you don't want to die, here's a tip for you.
I'm sorry. It just makes me laugh every time.
Every time. So this segment is not intended to be victim blaming. We thought of this segment because I read somewhere that a lot of people listen to true crime because they want to know what they can do to be safer. But in my mind, this is not meant to blame the victims. There for the grace of God go I.
Yes.
It's just learning from other people's experiences and mistakes. Sometimes we have no suggestions for a particular episode, and we'll just offer up generic tips.
So here I go. Substance abuse is part of the story, a very important part of the story. If you or someone you know is dealing with substance abuse, do not suffer in silence. There are many ways and resources to get well. And we can link those suggestions in our footnotes. If you listen to our show, you probably are already into podcasts. And not everybody can make it to a meeting. But there are some sobriety podcasts out there. And I was looking some of them up. Recovery Elevator and the Share podcasts are great if you are considering getting sober, or you know somebody who you think should get sober, or whatever. But they're kind of like attending an NA or an AA meeting in your headphones. So sometimes that's they're cool. hard to attend. So anyway, yeah, so there you go. Do we have any serial killer or crime news? Anything to report?
I wanted to go back to that Long Island serial killer case. Remember, I had that update on that story we talked about a while back. I have another update. They were supposed to the last update, they were supposed to release the 911 tape of the call made by Shannon Gilbert. I've been monitoring that because I really want to know what's on it. But New York police are still fighting it. They're claiming it will jeopardize the investigation if they release it. And they've already, said, the judge has already said, no, you have to release it, but they're still fighting it. And John Ray, the attorney for Gilbert's estate, finds the police's refusal suspicious. He believes the police investigation has been compromised. I don't know what that means. And the tapes, if they haven't already been destroyed, could reveal information damaging to the department. The public really has a right to know what's on those tapes, as well as Shannon's family. It will generate witnesses who are in the public who know what happened and perhaps will come forward. That's what the attorney said. A judge has twice ordered Suffolk County police to turn over the tape of the call, as well as others made by neighbors around the time of Gilbert's disappearance. In an October ruling, Judge Sanford Berland said the police department failed to provide the slightest intimation of how or why giving Gilbert's family access to the tapes would compromise any aspect of their protracted investigation.
So when I say cops are messy hoes,
this is an example.
What I mean, this is an example of messy hoedness. This is fuckery at its fucking finest. Bullshit. I
suspect that there's probably something on the tape that they'll find embarrassing or something like that.
Yeah, and you know, what's troubling about policing in America, there are some police, I don't know if it's unions or if it's on the legislature's responsibility or whatever, but I have heard that if some police departments, you can make any complaint you want about the police except about police brutality. Some other departments, if the complaint investigation is more than a year old, the police can never get disciplined. The rules that we have around these police departments are fucking wild and out of control.
So it's different everywhere.
So we say, yeah, it's different. It's different in every jurisdiction, but the bottom line is they're all pretty fucked up.
Yeah.
And not serving the people, only serving the officers and allowing them to behave badly. So now we're going to get into the part of our show where we shout out any content by people of color or about people of color or any marginalized groups, basically anybody who's not a straight cisgender white dude. And I wanted to shout out, since we were talking about Philadelphia today, a documentary that I saw years ago called Let the Fire Burn on Netflix. And the documentary takes place in Philadelphia. Since our case, again, took place in Philadelphia, I thought it was appropriate. It's about the group called MOVE, and they were a famous like civil rights kind of group. And the movie is about their downfall, and the documentary uses only footage from the time. There is no commentary by anybody. So, you know, normally in a documentary, you'll they're like little interview sessions. There's no
some narration or something.
No, not at all. This is all actual news footage. It's footage of the time. So as if you're like in a documentary, this is super, super fresh, super exciting. The documentary, again, uses only footage from the time. There is no commentary. MOVE is a Black liberation group founded in Philadelphia by John Africa, formed in 1972, and Donald Glacey. He was a social worker from the University of Pennsylvania. The name is not an acronym, which was a surprise to me. The group lived in a communal setting in West Philadelphia. West Philadelphia, born and raised on the abiding by philosophies of anarcho-primitivism, like
whatever that
would,
is.
They would eat, yeah, whatever, but they would have the, like the, they ate like raw food. They only ate raw food, and they would like feed the kids raw vegetables, but they'd also feed them like raw chicken. Like,
oh geez.
Uncooked chicken. Yeah, but the kids the kids were fine. The grown-ups wouldn't eat. But anyway, the grown-ups wouldn't eat the raw chicken, but the kids would. The U.S. government declared MOVE as a terrorist group. So the police went in and shot everybody and bombed the shit out of the house. And there were little kids inside.
Oh, man. This story sounds familiar. I may have read something about it, but I don't think I saw this documentary.
I saw it a few years ago, but pretty much everyone in the home died except for one little boy who lived to tell the tale. It's compelling, it's maddening, it's moving. I highly recommend it. Again, it's called Let the Fire Burn on Netflix.
Yeah, it sounds really interesting.
Our episode is going a little long. I'm so sorry, guys. Yeah. I went on so many tangents. So, where can the people find us?
Our website is fruitloopspod.com. Our Facebook page is Fruit Loops Pod. And our discussion group is Fruit Loops Pod Discussion on Facebook. We are also on Twitter and Instagram at Fruit Loops Pod. And links to our sources will be in our footnotes. If you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash App, which you can download on your phone. Or you can find online at cash.me/$FruitLoopsPod. Or you can become a monthly patron through our Podbean patron page. This will help us pay for things like our website and pod hosting. There's no minimum and no commitment. Even a dollar would help.
This is a weekly podcast and new episodes drop every Thursday. So until next time, look alive, guys. It's crazy out there.